This is an iHeart podcast.
Your holster is way more important than you think it is. It's just way more important than you think it is. What? Look, and I get that. The holster's not the sexy part of carrying firearms, right? You want to talk about your weapon and your ammunition. You want to talk about your safety training. You want to talk about how you did at the range. Oh, look at my groups. I was doing these failure drills today. And all that stuff's really important. I mean, really, really important. I'm not discounting that. But I've known so many people who do all those things. They take all the necessary steps, and then they carry with a holster they bought from a big box hunting store that was made 1,000 at a time. Please, don't put your life in one of those holsters. You need to trust Northwest Retention Systems because it's all custom-made gear. It's the only thing I carry around. NWRetention.com. That's NWRetention.com. Use the promo code Jesse. Gets you 10% off.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine you are in combat. Vicious combat. Bullets, bombs, bayonets, the works. You spend your time alternating between sickness, starvation, fear, anger, sadness, and boredom. That's pretty much combat summed up right there. And what's your worst fear when you're in combat? Look, you could speak for yourself if you've been there. Everybody's fears are probably different. My personal worst fear when I was there was to be captured and tortured. Probably pretty high on everybody's list along, you know, with the maiming and, you know, things like that. That was my worst fear. In general, you'll find that towards the top of everybody's list. You are in the middle of combat and everything that entails. You find yourself knocked out, which often happens in combat because of the explosions. Explosions can kill you with the shrapnel. Explosions can kill you with the concussion of it. But oftentimes, the concussion of an explosion is enough to knock you out, or at least daze you so severely you can't really function. You get knocked out in the middle of combat. You come to, shaking the fog out of your head, trying to figure out, what's happening? Did you win the battle? Where are you? Did you lose the battle? You decide you need to rub your eyes to try to shake out of this, and you lift your arm up, only your arm won't move, which is a little odd. Your heart's starting to beat a little faster now. You realize you are laying down on something, and your arms and legs are all tied down. You look across, down by your feet, to figure out what's happening as the panic starts to set in, and you find you are surrounded by 10 Japanese soldiers or so, and one of them approaching you with a scalpel, and he begins to lower it onto your naked abdomen. This is real. This is not made up. This is something that actually happened. And there's a reason, as much as I love them, as you well know, there's a reason to this day, 80-some-odd years later, there are people who will not visit Japan or buy anything made
in that country. This is the story of Kokoda Trail, something you almost undoubtedly have never heard of before, but one of the reasons we were able to win the war in the Pacific. And the sad part is most people have never heard of it before. It's actually really funny. There are some things that are like this in life, and I don't know how it happens, but you have these larger-than-life events, and you would think with something like World War II, which is, they call it the greatest of all history's man-made events, and when you think about the scale of it and the loss of life and the amount of territory it covered, there's probably not a debate in that. And you think about how many endless things you've seen, you've read, you've heard about it. My goodness, do a quick podcast search on your phone for World War II. Do a search on Amazon or Barnes & Noble for World War II books. Start scrolling. Let me know when you finish. I'll ruin it for you. You're still going to be scrolling at the end of this 3-hour radio show today. Movies, TV series. There's nothing covered more, talked about more than World War II. I would venture to say it's talked about more than the birth of Christ. We're not getting into that with you today, Chris. And yet, there are parts of World War II, interesting parts, I mean, some of the most interesting parts, in my opinion, that are hardly ever talked about. While you're doing that scroll on Amazon through the World War II books, let me know how long you scroll before you get to Kokoda Trail. I was doing this last night. I had read a couple things on it. I had actually downloaded a cool podcast on it. I like this podcast. We need to get this guy on, Chris. Find the guy who does the Battlecast podcast. He did a good one on Kokoda Trail. I listened to that yesterday as part of my prep for the show. Very, very good. I don't know the guy's name, but it's good. A little different, but it's good. I enjoyed it. But as part of my prep for today, I decided to sit down on Amazon Prime and see if I can get a documentary on it. I'll tell you, I often try to look for something visual on top of just reading or on top of just listening. I find it helps me. There's a reason I give you a quick Google image search task almost every day while we're doing this. Just a visual of some kind can help put you there. It can help put you there. And I dig in. I mean, it's freaking Amazon. I dig in and say, okay, well, I need a little more on this. Okay, I've got this article, I've got that article, I've got this story, got this podcast I listen to. Give me a visual. And I pull up the Amazon Prime World War II things available. World War II documentaries, single episodes, multi-part series, I mean, all these things. And I bet I scroll through 100 of these. Not one thing on the Kokoda Trail. It amazes me. There are parts of that war that just never get talked about. Poland, you know what you all know about Poland? What I know about Poland when it comes to World War II? Oh, Hitler invaded, took it over, then Russia split it. You know how extensive and vicious the fighting was after the Nazis took over and during the split and the war crimes and the Nazis are committing atrocities and the Soviets are, and you can't find anything on it. The Italian campaign. You know what? We're doing something on the Italian campaign soon, Chris. Nobody talks about it. It was essentially what won the war. It was the soft underbelly of Europe. And vicious fighting as the Germans, not the Italians, they were worthless, but as the Germans occupy these Italian mountains and allies having to fight their way through, it was awesome. But on to our story for the day. You've heard of New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, however you want to describe it. If you haven't, allow me to lay it out for you because I know there's a good chance you're driving at the moment or not in a position where you can picture what I'm talking about. Just north of Australia, I believe it's only about 150 miles north of Australia, there's an island. Now, I need to be clear, this island is not shaped like a rectangle. However, I'm going to tell you it looks like a rectangle because it makes it easier to envision this. It's a very, very, very rough rectangle. Hang on.
The Jesse Kelly Show.
HomeTitleLock.com can save you not only tens of thousands of dollars, it can save you from getting evicted. This is what happens. These online cyber thieves, they get a hold of your home title. They forge your signature on it, very easy for them. They take a loan out against it. They then take off with the money, and you get to pay that loan back. But you don't know you took out a loan, right? So you ignore it and ignore it and ignore it. And finally, when you discover it, either you're getting evicted or you have a major, major legal battle on your hands and you have to spend tens of thousands of dollars on an attorney plus time off work to get rid of it. Just go get Home Title Lock right now. Make your life easier. Go to HomeTitleLock.com, use the promo code Jesse, HomeTitleLock.com, promo code Jesse. Go there today. New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, whatever, it's an island, it doesn't matter. It's just north of Australia. I want you to picture a rectangle because this is going to matter to our story. With the long parts of the rectangle running east to west, the short parts running north to south. You got that? Here's what happened. The Japanese post Pearl Harbor, as you well know, the Japanese, well, they really got a foothold in the Pacific. Pearl Harbor was only one part of a multi-part series of coordinated attacks so the Japanese could essentially create a fortress over there in the Pacific. They wanted to lock the place down. Part of their campaign was they wanted to isolate Australia from the United States of America. And here's what I mean by isolate. This could be difficult to understand. This was the pre-internet era. This was pre-many things. You needed a lot more physical contact in order to exchange communication back then. A lot more than you need today. You could isolate Australia, and I mean isolate Australia if you're Japan. Now, contrary to popular opinion, there was never a major plan to invade Australia in Japan once again, or by the Japanese. Once again, you and I forget how huge Australia is. It's gigantic. It's like the size of the continental United States of America. The Japanese simply didn't have the manpower to take it, and even if they could take it, they could never defend it. They would never bother. So if you're not going to take it, at least isolate them. Part of that plan to isolate them, well, let's just be clear, the most important part of that plan to isolate Australia from the United States and the other allies, the most important part was taking Papua. You had to have it. You had to have it because it was the railway. It was the supply line to get to and from Australia. Now you're the Japanese. How are you going to go about this? Well, you remember that rectangle? I want you to go to the middle of it. The middle of that rectangle on the northern portion, on the northern part, there's a place called Buna. We're going to come back to that. Buna's in the north. That's the part that's towards Japan and towards China and all that. On the southern tip of that, there's a place called Port Moresby. You're the Japanese. You have naval superiority over the Australians by a long shot. Australia's Navy was crap. You have air superiority over the Australians by a long shot. Australia's Air Force or Air Corps, whatever you want to call it, total crap. Well, so that makes the planning of taking Papa and cutting off Australia from it real easy, doesn't it? Just go down to Port Moresby. Sail on down there, take that southern port, and what's Australia going to do? They obviously have an airstrip in Port Moresby. Port, as you can imagine, means you have shipping lanes there. Just go take Port Moresby and you've cut them off. That's the point you need to take. The Japanese were not stupid. They were extremely capable, very good planners. They decided to cruise on down to Port Moresby, which makes the Battle of the Coral Sea interesting. You've probably heard of it. I think we've probably talked about it on this show at some point. I don't know. It's all running together. But just understand this. This was essentially the first naval battle between the United States of America and the Japanese. Our aircraft carriers versus their aircraft carriers and all the ships surrounding it. We didn't win the Battle of the Coral Sea. Tactically, the Japanese kind of won the Battle of the Coral Sea. We lost a lot. They lost a lot. But it's one of those interesting moments where losses can be wins. You see, we all walked away, the Japanese and us, from the Battle of the Coral Sea damaged. But the Japanese had two major, major problems after that. One, they couldn't repair their ships like we could. We took our damaged ships, sent them right back to America, where America's industry patched them right up and got them right back out on the water. Japan didn't have that ability. They didn't have the resources, the manpower to pull that off. Those Japanese ships that were damaged, they didn't make it back into the water in time for the Battle of Midway. Maybe you've heard of it. That's one big loss for the Japanese. The second big loss, remember, the Japanese weren't just out sailing their fleet through the ocean to enjoy the sunshine and waves. They were on their way down to Port Moresby. Oops, can't get there now. The United States Navy stopped us. And I remember, when I say loss, it's not as if we limped away. We both limped away. Oh, wow, that was a tough fight. You could even call it a win. Well, you're the Japanese. That doesn't change the fact you have got to have Port Moresby. Okay, you can't sail there. What are you going to do? You land on Buna with a large land force, 20,000 dudes. That number's disputed, but everything's disputed. You land on Buna, and you march down from the north, down south to Port Moresby. That's the plan. But there's a problem with the plan. No, the problem is not the number of Australians on Papa defending it. There were really only about 2,000 Australians. Again, all these numbers are disputed. Some say 500, some say 3,000, some say more. But the Australians were heavily, heavily outnumbered. Okay, that's fine. We're the Japanese, and the Japanese landed their elite troops on there. It's not like they sent the scraps. So this shouldn't be an issue, right? If you're Japan, well, on paper, no. But the route from Buna down to Port Moresby, it's not a road. It's not a superhighway. It's a trail or a track, depending on how you want to put it. It's called the Kokoda Track or Kokoda Trail. You can Google image search it right now if you'd like. It's quite literally a one-man track through the jungle, through the mountains, through the mud. It's a living hell. That's the Japanese side. And remember, what have we always talked about? 20,000 troops versus 2,000 or 3,000 sounds real nice, right? If you're the Japanese, sounds like you got this thing wrapped up. Except those troops, they aren't robots. Those troops don't exist on paper. Those troops are flesh and blood like you and I. What have you done so far today? You've slept, woke up. You've drank water. You've eaten. As a human being, you have needs. So do the Japanese. Hang on. Just got another great night's sleep last night with my ebb sleep. I get a great night's sleep every night with my ebb sleep. And I love that it's not pills. I don't like pills. I don't like drugs. I don't like taking things into my body. And I don't want to burst your bubble. And I'm certainly not pointing fingers because I've been there. But you know that sleeping pill sleep you're getting, you know that's not good sleep, right? Ebb sleep actually targets the root cause of your sleeplessness, and it does it without drugs. It's a wearable device. You put it on. It applies precise, continuous cooling to your forehead, calming you down, calming down those racing thoughts, putting you asleep quickly, and maybe the best part, keeping you asleep. Go to tryebb.com/Jesse. That's tryebb.com/Jesse. Use the promo code Jesse at checkout. That gets you $25 off. Well, you've both got quite an issue. Japan's issue is this. You've got 20,000 dudes, you just landed on Papa, and you don't have an airfield, and you don't have the ability to feed these guys, and 20,000 dudes eat a lot of food. For Australia, you've got quite an issue too. Yours might be even more daunting. One, you're outnumbered 10-1. Two, you have supplies to feed your guys, but it's not endless. And three, if those Japanese tear through you and take the port, you're effed big time as a country, completely cut off from Allied support. This is one of those moments in gigantic wars that decide the outcome. You lose enough of these, you lose the war. You win enough of these, you win the war. The Japanese start their way south. The Australians, just as they did in World War I, turned out to be tough as nails. Absolutely tough as nails. You see, the Australians have a proud military tradition. And the Australians, knowing how critical this was and knowing there was a real limit on how many crack troops they could put in the field. They had reservists, but reservists are reservists. They're accountants you give a weapon to once every once in a while to make sure they can shoot relatively straight. The Australians recalled a couple battalions from the Middle East that had been there fighting the Germans. Remember, the war had been going on a couple years by now. So they recall some of their crack troops. Imagine that. You're an Australian. You've been fighting these tough Germans in the Middle East. You get a phone call that you're pulling out. Woohoo, finally. Where are we going? Oh, you're going to the jungle to fight the Japanese. And they throw these guys into the maw. And this thing is ugly. Very, very ugly, because it's just a constant, well, it's constantly this. The Japanese marching their way through the jungle. The Japanese were excellent, excellent jungle fighters, excellent night fighters. They trained extensively at that before the war because they knew they were going to be fighting in the jungles all over, for one, and two, at nighttime, because they thought the Western powers were soft and scared, and they thought they could absolutely terrorize them into capitulating if they continuously fought them at night. That turned out to very much not be right. One, with the Australians. Two, with the Americans, especially the United States Marine Corps. Not pumping up my own guys here. The Marines really, really, really do good work at night. You're not going to storm through a Marine Corps defensive position at night. Not without paying for it badly. Now, these Australians were the same. Highly trained, dug in, and ready. But remember, heavily, heavily outnumbered. So it would go like this. The Australians would have dug in defensive positions. The Japanese would, and this part I was, there are so many brave people on both sides in combat. And we're going to go over a couple things that are going to make you once again hate the Japanese before this is over. But you can still respect some things like this. Because the trail was so thin, remember, oftentimes just a one-man trail, you don't know where the Australians are. The Japanese don't have air cover, and even if you did, it's triple canopy jungle, most of it. You can't see, even if you're flying planes right over it. You don't know where they are. So there's only one way to figure out where the Australians are. You pick one guy or find a volunteer. From what we know about the Japanese during World War II, they probably had volunteers lined up, and you simply send him forward until he gets shot, and then you say, oh, that's where the Australians are. What does that feel like when you're given that order as a Japanese soldier in World War II? Or if you volunteered, either way. And I understand there's a certain amount of belief there. Die for the emperor, all that stuff. I get that. You have things in your life you're willing to die for, undoubtedly. Like your family or Red Lobster. But are you excited about it? What does that feel like? You're already miserable. The Japanese troops were starting to get hungry as they worked their way down. And you, hey, come here, Yamamoto. There's the trail. Might want to get your last rites in now, because you're marching up the trail until you die to let us know where they are. And you simply grab your weapon and start walking. What does that feel like, waiting, knowing, waiting for that first bullet to hit you? What's going through your mind? Probably wondering where it's going to hit, right? Please just get me in the heart or the head if you wouldn't mind. No, not the groin. What, Chris? That's the kind of stuff you think about. And they would scout. The Japanese scout would get shot. The Japanese would then know where the Australians were, and the Japanese would do a combined frontal assault along with flanking on one or both sides, depending what the terrain would allow. You see, that's what having the numbers allow you to do. That great Napoleon line, quantity has a quality all its own. You can only do so much if you're the Australians. You're dug in, you're fighting. Now they're coming at you from all sides and often coming at you at night. And you're constantly being overrun. That's not the exception, that's the rule. And let's just discuss that for a moment, what that looks like, what that feels like. You are dug into a fighting hole. You know the Japanese are coming up the mountain or down the mountain at you. You're on a ridgeline, so you're going to be up or down depending. In general, you're the defender because you're the Australians, so you're probably going to choose the high ground whenever possible, almost undoubtedly. The Japanese are going to be coming up at you, but they're going to be coming up at you from the dark. From the pitch black, I have been in the triple canopy jungle at night. You've never experienced darkness like that in your life unless you go close yourself in your closet and turn out the lights. The moon is gone. The stars are gone. You can see your hand in front of your face if you put it about 5 inches in front, maybe. Your eyes can't adjust enough to that lack of light. You're dug in. You're looking about 10, 15 yards to your right. There's a couple of your buddies dug in. 10, 15 yards to your left, couple of buddies dug in there. You can't see them. And the Japanese, you know they're coming, but the Japanese moved really, really quietly in the jungle. Again, it was their specialty. Oftentimes, the Australians wrote about this after the fact. The Japanese would get within 5 yards of the front of the fighting hole before blowing a whistle as a signal to charge. What's the most scared you've ever been in your life? Hang on.
Jesse Kelly. You're listening to The Jesse Kelly Show.
GoldAlliance.com/Jesse. While I'm talking to you, go there. I need to emphasize this point because I think some of you are confused. I am not telling you to do something radical, completely change your financial portfolio. I'm not telling you any of that. All I'm telling you to do is get a gold IRA. That should be part of every single person's portfolio. Why in the world would you not have some precious metals as part of your portfolio? Look at the markets. You saw what the Dow did yesterday, didn't you? Do you think that's the last time? What's that old saying in finance? Trees don't grow to the sky. There's a limit to all this. Just be ready for when the correction comes. Go to goldalliance.com/Jesse. You can actually get up to $5,000 in gold and silver coins. Goldalliance.com/Jesse. Five yards in front of you. Whistle blows, Japanese attack. You're shooting, they're shooting. So now not only can you not see, this is a part of combat they don't talk about enough. You can't hear lots of the time. Gunfire is loud, yours and theirs. Your ears are ringing even when there isn't shooting. It's hard to communicate. And it's turning into bayonet fights. They're jumping into trenches, into foxholes, fighting holes with samurai swords, hand-to-hand combat. You're having to take breaks from shooting to try to avoid getting your head chopped off in the middle of the night. You just finished beating somebody to death, and now you have to pick that weapon up and shoot it again. We're talking horror. You also can't tell who's who. Remember when I told you could barely see or not see the guys to your right or left? What do you do when the Japanese do take that fighting hole, which they will, because they have more guys than you do? Sometimes you can't tell. And you know they're flanking you. When do you leave? How do you leave? Do you leave? And that's really the great question for today. How do you get out of that? When do you get out of that? And can you make yourself get out of that at the appropriate time? The tactical retreat is the most, absolutely, it is the most, without question, underrated battlefield tactic on earth. I remember, I obviously grew up hearing about George Washington. And what do you know about him as a kid, right? First American president, great general. And you hit the high points. That's what you and I do. You hit the high points on things. And I remember thinking, man, what a stud. And you picture this, you build up this image in your mind of George Washington. You know, when he's not signing, you know, doing presidential things, he's out there cutting British throats for fun. Leading the charge, doing all these great things. And I remember the first time I started digging into George Washington, not the president, the general beforehand, the military man. And he has a laundry list of battles won and great things he did even before he was a general. Very brave man. But I remember how disappointed I was as a teenage boy when I found out Washington's specialty as a general was the tactical retreat. I remember how thinking how lame that was. His specialty was running away? What? Until I grew up a bit and I learned it's one of, if not the most difficult things to pull off. You have to know when to pull your men back so they can live to fight another day. You have to keep them calm while you do it. And you have to do it the right way, because guess when entire units get mopped up and slaughtered? They get mopped up and slaughtered when they rout, when they throw their weapons down, as men will do, or when they hold their weapons but turn around and run the other direction. And let me tell you, when you're watching the Japanese carve out your buddy's throat 5 feet away from you and they're surrounding your position, you will want to run the other way. It is everything. Sometimes, especially when you're outnumbered, and you don't have to just defend this point if you're the Australians, you have to defend the entire trail between here and Port Moresby because they can't be allowed to take the port. So you have to pull back. And not just from a commander, from an individual level. You have to make choices when you're doing a tactical retreat. When you're pulling back, you have to make choices that will haunt you when you're 90 on your deathbed. You'll be thinking about them. It's not the enemy you kill that stay with you. You're talking about your buddy laying there, wounded, begging you not to leave him behind. And you have to, or you're all going to die. And the last thing you see is your buddy being surrounded by Japanese troops. and the heroism these Australians showed time and again, where one man would man a heavy machine gun and tell everybody else, go, just go, I'll hold them off while you run. And he was never seen again. That's the stuff you never, ever, ever forget. Hang on.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Part of the tactical retreat the Australians were continuously doing as they would fight and pull back and fight and pull back. Part of that tactical retreat is leaving men behind. You can't get out, saying goodbye. And the Australians, in the rare occasion they would get a surrendering Japanese or find one knocked out, they were starting to kill them. Now, why were Australians committing what were basically war crimes? Well, the Australians were starting to get upset, to put it mildly. Why would Australians be so upset? Australians were finding out, for really the first time, what was happening to their brothers in arms if they were captured alive during this tactical retreat, and it's really bad.
Jesse Kelly returns next. This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
Japanese, as you know by now, did things in World War II that were jaw-droppingly horrific. Is that right? Is that fair? And the reason I ask if that's fair is this. They were jaw-droppingly horrific. It was cruel, and I mean unnecessarily cruel. We're not talking about putting you in a prison and just not having the food to feed you so you slowly starve. We're talking about intentional cruelty, subhuman cruelty. But remember, how many shows have we done on Romans and Spartans and Genghis Khan and Scythians and Persians and all these people? What they did to people during World War II is much more common historically than this new advanced thing. They just hadn't advanced. Is that a nice way to put that, Chris? Is that being way too kind and apologetic to them just because you know I apologize for? But that's really what it was. That's how the Japanese viewed warfare. Winner take all. When you win, you do whatever you want to the other person. When they win, they're going to do the same to you. They would take Australian prisoners. They would chop off their heads with samurai swords. Not just soldiers either. There were civilians, you know, villagers, tribes living in there that many would help the Australians. Obviously, it was worse for the women. Chopping heads off. Australians at one point in time tried to escape. They were recaptured, at which point the Japanese shot them in the feet. The Japanese would pull out fingernails routinely. And remember our story at the beginning of the show? This is the part that I can't wrap my mind around this. It doesn't seem real. This is not the only time this happened during the war either. The Japanese would bring in medical students and sometimes just doctors in front of the medical students. They would bring them along on these military campaigns and they would take Australian prisoners they'd captured alive, tie them down, and with no anesthesia, they would carve out their livers while they were alive. What does that sound like? How can you do that to another human being? I mean, value systems or not, East, West, old school, new school, how can you approach another human being, a soldier who was fighting you bravely, didn't hurt your wife and kids or anything, how can you approach another human being and carve his liver out of his body while he's alive, and his heart? These medical experiments were also done on Americans during the war, too. We'll talk about that another time. And honestly, a lot of this stuff pales in comparison to what the Japanese were doing to the Chinese during World War II. We don't care about that as much because not exactly big fans of the Chinese at the moment, but remember, they were just innocent Chinese people, not a bunch of card-carrying commies. Ugly stuff. Well, the Japanese, yes, it's going well for them as they're advancing, but they are running into a problem. What have we said time and time and time again? That amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. They're now starving. I do not mean hungry. I mean starving to death. They're so hungry, the Australians, who are hungry but not starving, have figured out it's the one great advantage they have over the Japanese. So these crafty Australians, they start setting up food ambushes where they'll leave food behind. The Japanese are so hungry they can't help themselves. They would see food and sometimes fight each other over it. And they'd mob these food drops, and the Australians would be waiting there with a heavy machine gun aimed at it and just mow down the Japanese 20 or 30 at a time. How sweet is that? Now remember, the Australians are continuously retreating, though, always moving backwards, always. Finally, after this goes on and on and on, this entire affair went on from July to November. How much misery is that? We haven't even gone over the disease. Finally, the Japanese get to the high ground overlooking Port Moresby. The Japanese say they were so happy to see Port Moresby because there was food there. It wasn't about the objective. They had to get there to eat. They were so happy, some of them wept with joy as they overlooked Port Moresby, knowing they'd won, and then word came down from Japanese command, turn around and go back to Buna. You see, MacArthur, as many problems as I have with MacArthur, he had organized an American landing on Guadalcanal. The Japanese had allowed the Americans behind them, and they no longer could afford to take Port Moresby. They had to pull the troops back. And this is, I don't expect you to feel sorry for him, but this is one of the more heartbreaking moments. The Japanese do pull back. They begin, as they're pulling back, to form suicide battalions. You would just ask for volunteers, and you would have several of them if you were a Japanese commander. All right, I need 50 guys who are going to commit suicide today. We got to hold them off because now the Australians are getting reinforcements in the shoes on the other foot. The Japanese are now at a point of hunger so badly, they're eating each other. Cannibalism in the jungle. They're pulling back suicide battalions. Some Japanese pull clear back to Buna and wait for their evacuation, and there were problems with the evacuation. Some of them were left on the beaches starving to death, had to melt back into the jungle where they fell down and died and starved to death. Japanese never took Port Moresby. The Australians, their stance at the Kokoda Track, the Kokoda Trail, it changed World War II. Sometimes the smart thing, the thing that can win you the war, is the thing that doesn't feel good at all. It's the thing they don't make movies about. It's called the tactical retreat. I actually have some advice today, not for people on the right, for people on the left. Not that they're sane enough to listen to me. These leftists are about to make a gigantic mistake with Amy Coney Barrett, the lady who I'm hearing is almost a shoo-in by now to be Trump's nominee. You see, she's a devout Catholic mother, arch-conservative, and people on the left are horrified at what that's going to mean for their agenda as the Supreme Court slips. You saw how they treated Kavanaugh. They are lathering up to destroy this lady. However, they need to make themselves tactically retreat. You see, we have an election coming up, and leftists are about to make a big, big mistake.
You don't have to dip forever. You know that, Ryan. You don't have to smoke forever. And the reason I say it like that is I have been that guy. I've been that guy. I dipped for so long. And what would happen is I would decide I'm going to quit. Oh, that's bad for me. I'm going to quit. I'm a man. I don't need any help. I'm just going to quit cold turkey. And I would fail time and time and time again. I tried things like the patch. That didn't work. Gum, sunflower seeds. I tried it all. It's just a matter of finding the right thing to help you quit. That's Jake's Mint Chew. Go, put in your dip. Just make sure it's Jake's Mint Chew. It's tobacco-free. It's nicotine-free. It's even sugar-free. And I highly recommend, just a personal choice, I highly recommend their CBD pouches because it really helps take that extra edge off. Get a jakesmintchew.com. That's jakesmintchew.com. Make sure you use the promo code Jesse at checkout. When you do that, get 10% off.
This is an iHeart podcast.